Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for being timely, and hope you had a good break. They really work us hard here, don't they? This is late afternoon. Fortunately, the powers that be have scheduled an extraordinarily exciting, stimulating, and informative session for you as the last panel of the day. My name is Ellen Chaffee. I'll be introducing my panel members momentarily. I'd like to give a quick introduction to the topic, though, first. The topic is the completion agenda. And it's one of the most significant agenda items facing colleges and universities today throughout this country. As you can see, basically, it's listed second on this list of big issues facing higher education, but really it permeates about half of those issues and is relevant to, and certainly is relevant to, the future of our country. The issue is, it's not enough for students to go to college. Students need to complete their academic plans. They need to get their degree, their certificate, whatever it is, ideally a degree. And the state of West Virginia needs to have as many of those folks as possible, because the economy increasingly depends on it, as we heard from the chancellor earlier today. So that's our topic, and we have some very great experts here to tell us more about it. But first, I want to remind you that to listen with your board member ears on. Be a governor as you listen, and I'd like to propose a way for you to do that. With apologies to those of you who were in the same lunch session with me, I'll repeat my role of the board slide, because I find that a lot of people find it memorable and helpful in thinking about what the role of the board is. The aircraft carrier is your university. The red smiley faces are the people who work there. You can't even see most of them because they're working inside the ship. And the yellow star is your president. And you are up there in the helicopter, along with, by the way, the president. The president as your partner, and as the commander of the ship, but also as your partner in the board. And one of the primary points I like to make in connection with this slide is it helps illustrate your role. As you've been hearing, your role is to look to the future, is to look beyond, is to spot things in the long term and help set the direction. So that's a good place to be when that's your role. It also points out that you're responsible for two organizations. You're responsible for your university, and you're also responsible for the board itself as an organization. And that's one of the reasons AGB is so pleased to be part of this event every year. As a final point of introduction, here's a slide that has to do with how boards can be game changers. This is something of a play on words, because we're going to hear about CCA and its work with game changers. But also, Dr. Meredith was talking to us about how important it is for boards to be consequential, to make a difference, to be, in effect, game changers. And how do you do that? A couple of points I'd like to highlight. First is the third one, that you're not here to solve problems, but to imagine vibrant new futures. And the fact that we need more college graduates is a current problem to be solved, but the vibrant new future is a thriving economy and higher family incomes and more successful economically and socially states. So this is an opportunity in a very specific way to imagine a vibrant new future for your region and your state. Second, if you look at the item four, you have the capability of focusing attention. One of the important things that board members, that boards as a whole do, is to focus the attention of the institution on something that's really important. And once you get everybody inside the institution and around the institution focused on one or two or three key things, you can really move that ship in a big hurry. So with that, we're going to hear why we focus on completion from Dr. Hill, what Complete College America is doing to enhance completion from Dr. Bruce Vandell, and how West Virginia University is enhancing completion from Provost Joyce McConnell. So without further ado, Paul.
Try to use it this way, Ellen. Thank you, Ellen, and certainly thanks to Bruce and Joyce for being with us here this afternoon. So the question is, why focus on completion? I think, as I remarked earlier, the goal is to not only get students into college, but to get them through college so that they can join the workforce and have productive lives. And I quite personally think that it's important to focus on those students who have already come to that point in their life where they've made a decision they want to go to college. What the data tell us is that we see numerous students dropping out, particularly the sophomore year or at the end of the freshman year. We lose a lot of students in that zone. We lose them in other areas too, but that's a big area to watch, getting them through the first year. So my thought is, and this is borne out by some of the data, is really focusing on this second, this timeline of entering the second year of college is an important time that we spend a lot of time focusing on their completion, keeping them on track, keeping them in school, doing whatever it is we need to mentor to support them. So this is some of the mechanisms you'll hear about relative to how we go about accomplishing that. So among our 2007 student cohort, 46% of those students who entered the system completed their degrees in 6 years here in West Virginia. Graduation rates at our institutions range from a high of 56% to a low of 18%. So we have differing rates, and we have differing student populations across the state. So we know there's more to be done. And many of the students who do not complete on time are some of the most disadvantaged students. We know that lower income students drop out at a higher rate for whatever reason, the resources that they need at that point in time, or sometimes it's just the fear that they simply might not be able to complete and they're running up debt in the process. So too often these students leave without a degree and often a lot of debt. And I think any one of us in a community across West Virginia knows of some student who has gone through that experience. And that word gets around to other potential students that this individual went to one of our institutions for a couple of years or any institution, dropped out, has a lot of debt, and now is in real financial trouble because they don't have a job either. And that gets around. It spreads, and I think it leads to this very negative impression and why we need to focus on getting these students through the system. So I don't believe students enroll in order to drop out. You know, there are things that we can do to ensure that they can achieve, that they can complete their dreams. I think that's why Complete College America's 15 to Finish is one of the things we've implemented here in West Virginia. We kicked that off about this time last year. It's really gone into high gear, and it's one of Complete College America's game changers, which you have that the game changers document in your packet. It's something that you can take a look at. It's one of several different strategies that are called the game changers that Bruce, I'm sure, will share with you further. And there's evidence also that transfer students in West Virginia persist and graduate at lower rates. So students that transfer, and we know students now, we're getting data that students transfer a lot. one in three students will go to two institutions. One in five students will go to more than two institutions in their academic lifetime. So we want to help students succeed, and that's why we're working on transfer as well that we've been talking about this morning. So, and of course, we know that's needed for the state's economy. You've heard those other statistics that by 2020, 51% of West Virginia's jobs will require an associate's degree or higher. And of course, we're right now only at 27% of our population who has that. We know that the value of a college degree is vast and it's growing. And the income gap between college graduates and those without degrees has hit an all-time high. In fact, Americans with four-year degrees made on an average of 98% more per hour in 2013 than those without a degree. And we know that college graduates on the average tend to make more than $1 million more in their working careers than those without. So when our students walk across the stage with their diplomas, they're walking toward an undeniable benefit of having that degree, and they're really helping the state and its economy by doing so. So again, that's why completion is so important, to focus on those students who have made the decision to pursue a college career and to help them find a complete experience in doing so, rather than losing them in the system by maybe not paying as much attention as we should to them. So Bruce, I'll turn it to you.
Great, thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you today. My name is Bruce Vandell with Complete College America. Complete College America is a national advocacy organization that works with states very closely on really one thing. How do we dramatically increase the percentage of students and number of students in the United States of America who have a college credential? And we've been around since 2009, and since that time, we have built an alliance, about 33 states, as well as the District of Columbia and the Northern Marianas Island Territory. So we are a big organization working with state policy leaders from across the country on strategies related to college completion. And, you know, for the last 150 years, a primary narrative in higher education is about expanding access, right? How we've moved from having higher education only available to the elites to one where it's become a mass, an opportunity for the masses, an opportunity for folks to get ahead, to get a job, to participate in our economy. And we've done a very good job of that. We've dramatically, over the course of the last 100 years or so, done amazing things to create new opportunities for people to access higher education. And as Paul mentioned, access has been something that we emphasize and that is important, but we are increasingly recognizing that it's not just simply access, but actually graduation and completion that must be a priority. And believe it or not, from a public policy perspective, it was only in the very recent years that we've begun to really focus in on how higher education institutions can do a better job of graduating students. And in fact, you may not know this, okay, but West Virginia is actually, could make the case for being the birthplace for the national college completion movement. You may not be aware of this, but right around the time, around 2008, 2009, right when CCA was started, the National Governors Association had an initiative and issued a report called Complete to Compete, and made the case for why this country needed to dramatically increase college completion rates in order to compete. If you remember 2008 and 2009, things weren't too good in this country economically, right? And so the governors were recognizing what they needed to do in order to get the economy back on track, and one of the primary objectives was putting a greater emphasis on college attainment and doing what we could to improve college attainment. And one of the people who was leading that effort and was chair of the National Governors Association at that time is your distinguished guest this evening, then Governor, now Senator Manchin, who, working with Complete College America and other national organizations, identified a set of priorities and goals around college completion. And in addition to that, a way for institutions and states to measure whether or not they were making progress towards college completion goals. And so Complete College America, one of the first things that we did when we invited states to participate in our organization was to agree to collect data on how well they are doing in terms of graduating students. But not only whether or not students are completing college, but whether they're also hitting key milestones that we know are essential to track whether or not institutions are doing their job towards college completion. So yes, we collect data on completion rates, but we also collect data and work with states on data in terms of the percentage of students who are enrolled in remedial education. Whether or not students enrolled in remedial education or otherwise are passing gateway college courses in math and English. In other words, if you're familiar with remediation, many students have to take these courses to access that are non-credit, that don't go towards a degree, but they still have to pay for, in order to prepare themselves for college-level courses. So, we want to measure the percentage of students who are in remediation, and then how well those students do, whether or not they actually enroll in college-level courses. We track the number of credits that students are taking, because we know if students are going to graduate, obviously we need to see credit accumulation. And we also track the time it takes the students to complete a college credential and the number of credits it takes for a student to complete a college credential, because we know that the longer it takes and the more credits students are accumulating beyond what they normally should have to accumulate undermines their ability to graduate. So, for example, in the state of West Virginia, it takes about 140 credits for a student to earn a bachelor's degree here in West Virginia, when in fact the standard is 120 credits. And the average time to degree in West Virginia is about 5 years to earn a post-secondary credential. And so we know that there's some inefficiencies built into the system, right? That students are taking credits that they don't need to graduate, they're taking longer than 4 years to complete. And also there's a couple other things we know. We know that a very low percentage of students who are enrolled in remedial education in West Virginia are completing these gateway college courses in two academic years. A little over 20% are completing math and English courses within two academic years, which means it's delaying their ability to get off on the right foot to earning a college credential. So working with Paul and working with your community college system and others, it's been important to then identify. So looking at those numbers, and just for your information, the numbers I shared with you are very consistent across the country. West Virginia is not unique. There's definitely, consistently, these challenges exist at every institution that you would encounter. So when you look at that data, then the question, of course, then is, what are we going to do about it, right? How do we reduce the time to degree? How do we reduce the number of unnecessary credits that students are taking? How do we increase the number of students who are passing college-level math and English courses in their first academic year? And that's what gets to, and Ellen and Paul both mentioned to it earlier, our efforts around very distinct and specific, what we call game-changer completion strategies that have been implemented at campuses across the country and are getting tremendous results in terms of addressing these key metrics related to completion. We're not talking about 4 or 5% increases in success rates here. We're talking about strategies that are getting, some cases, 10, 20, 30%, even more than that in terms of success when it comes to implementing these reforms. And so our work and the work we've been doing with states is how they might implement some of these game changer reforms. And I'll run through them very quickly because I don't want to spend a lot of time on them, but we can definitely talk about them more. One is, how do we address the problem of remediation? And one thing that we know is that when you put students in multiple courses that don't count towards a degree and that they have to pay for, inevitably students don't want to take those courses and they end up dropping out of the system, right? So one strategy that's proved to be very, very successful is to place more students into college-level courses, the courses that actually count to a degree, and just provide them more support in that class. An extra hour of time, maybe a lab, anything that you can do to ensure that the student passes that college level course. We call that co-requisite remediation. That is, instead of having students take all these courses before they get access to the college level course, have them take that course and then give them the support they need in that course. And believe it or not, when you do that, you get success rates in the college level courses for those students that are 2, 3, 4 times the success rates for the students when before they were in prerequisite remediation. So we are working very hard with states to implement co-requisite remediation. And in fact, West Virginia is a national leader on this issue. The community colleges in particular have made it a priority to implement co-requisite remediation. In fact, they implemented the reforms this past fall. And lo and behold, the results are dramatic. students who were before passing college-level courses in the teens, 15%, are now passing at about 65%. And so this is a pretty dramatic change. And so we are obviously looking to work more with West Virginia. I would love to work with your institutions on this very same issue. So that's the one, and I'm going to shorten it from there. A second issue is what we call 15 to finish. You've heard reference from that from Paul. And the idea here is that many students enter college campuses, even when they enroll full time, they only take 12 credits a term. If you were to have a room of students and ask them, how many years do you plan on taking to graduate? Most will say, I'm going to be done in 4 years. Then you ask them, are you taking 15 credits a term? And they'll say, no, I'm not taking 15 credits a term. Well, if you do the math, if you don't take 15 credits a term, you're not going to graduate in 4 years. And in fact, many students are taking 12 credits a term, which automatically puts them on the five-year plan. And the fact of the matter is if you could get students to enroll in 15 credits a term, you increase their likelihoods of graduation, you're going to decrease their time to degree, and it's going to save them a lot of money. In fact, to the tune of about $65,000, when it comes right down to it, for every extra year you're in higher education in terms of lost wages and the additional cost of higher education. So we are pushing institutions, and of course West Virginia, again, is becoming a leader in terms of challenging and working with students to encourage them to enroll in 15 credits. And believe it or not, doing so doesn't impact them negatively academically.
It doesn't.
The research is very clear that no matter what academic level you come into the institution, if you take 15 credits a term, you're still going to perform actually better than students, or at least as equal to students who are taking lower credit loads. So once again, a strategy that's a sort of a no-brainer, straightforward approach to increasing college completion. The other two strategies I'll mention just very briefly. One is called Guided Pathways to Success, which is basically how do we, when students enter our institutions, how do we get them quickly advise them and guide them into a path for a program as quickly as we can. Instead of having them sort of flounder about for a year or two, taking classes here and there, not really knowing what their goals are, how do we engage them right when they walk in the door, get them on at least an initial path? Maybe it's not a specific major, but let's say, well, I'm interested in health sciences. Maybe I'm not sure if I want to be a nurse or pre-med or something else, but get them into a broad area of study, get them the basic courses in that area, and then ultimately have them make a choice of major, hopefully within the first academic year, and then provide them a semester-by-semester plan all the way to graduation. Excuse me. Institutions that are doing that are dramatically decreasing the time to degree, dramatically increasing college completion rates, and are also decreasing the number of unneeded, unnecessary credits that students are taking, so you're actually reducing the cost of their college education. And the last strategy we call structured schedules, which is very simply, how do we create opportunities for students to take courses that enable them to balance family, work, and school obligations? When we have 75% of the students in higher education are what we call non-traditional students, adults, you know, students with families and other obligations, how do we make sure that higher education works for them? Well, one way to do that is to make sure that they take the courses at a time that's convenient for them in blocks. So instead of having them take a course on Monday at 8 a.m. and then the next course isn't available till 3 p.m. and then they have courses on Tuesdays and Thursdays that are, you know, at different times, how can you create a schedule where maybe they take courses either in a morning block, I'm there from 8 till noon, an afternoon block, I'm there from noon to 4, et cetera, so that students are getting the classes in a block, they're taking better advantage of their time, they can get the support they need, and then they could get out with the rest of their life, getting onto their jobs or to their families. And so those four strategies, believe it or not, when you implement them, you can see dramatic increases in college completion. And we're very excited that West Virginia is actually one of our great lead states in terms of working on many of these efforts. And we look forward to continue to doing that and love to have more of a conversation about these efforts here in West Virginia.
Thank you, Gary. Can everyone hear me? Great. Okay, good. So the topic of this wonderful book that you have in your packet is Consequential Boards. And you heard Dr. Meredith say earlier, none of us want to be in inconsequential boards, right? Which I think is absolutely correct. And so I would like my consequential board from WVU to stand up, actually, just so people know who you are. Because this board actually acted truly as a consequential board in, and you can, there's one all the way in the back, trying to hide. I got to call you out. And the reason why I wanted them to stand up is because they truly have been a consequential board for us in terms of its support for student success. And they have been our partners and really have had a vision about what it means to move students from access to success. And in fact, I would say, while they have been our partners, they have also been our conscience, because the board often are the people who bring to us their sense of what's happening with the public trust in higher education, because they're our boots in the field, in a sense, hearing every day what it is that people are saying. And so if you look in this book that you've received, on page 17, it gives you recommendations for change. And the number one recommendation for change in this book is the restoration of public trust in higher education. And I think that there's probably nothing we can do that is more important than to make the public aware that we take seriously our obligation for student success. And the more that we can talk about it, and the more we have the support of our boards in doing that, I think the more successful we can be in changing the perception of higher education. Now, obviously, the second thing that we could do is provide quality education at lower cost. One of the dilemmas about putting into place all of the kinds of programs that we need for student success is that they cost an institution. And so it challenges the institution to think creatively about how it's going to do it and how it is going to reallocate resources. And I think that that's something that we have to be very aware of and to be very forthright with our boards, that when we're talking about this transition from simply a focus on access to a real focus on success, we're going to be disrupting the status quo within a university. And that means that we really have to have partnerships, very strong partnerships with our board, with the public, with our faculty, with our staff, and with our students. This is an all-in proposition for all of us at this moment in time. So what we undertook at West Virginia University, and many of the institutions in West Virginia are doing this as well, so I just happen to be the spokesperson up here for what we're doing specifically at WVU, but I know that there are many of you in this room who know that your institutions are doing wonderful things as well. In terms of student success, we really began to focus, as I said, on success and impact. And we started looking at both the macro level and the micro level. And by looking at the macro level, I mean we really started to look very seriously at data. What is our data telling us about who's successful, why they're successful, when they're successful, and looking then at all of the information that we could find about success. On the micro level, and I know Adam Green, I think, is still here, and Adam will understand when I say how important this is. Once we looked at the macro level at the data, we also looked at the micro level, and I think of the micro level as the individual student. What is it about the individual student and the individual experience that's going to make a difference? Because I really do believe that the approach to success is very individualized. Now, we can do it in larger ways. So one reason I think Paul asked me to participate in this panel is West Virginia University has 32,000 students. It admits 5,200 freshmen every year. If what we're talking about is the use of data tells us we need to do certain things with individual students, That's a real challenge. How do you do that with 5,200 students? And the way you do it is you begin to think about large programs that can touch individual students where they are. Before I go on to talk about those particular strategies, I do want to mention that on the policy side, We have done everything that at college, Complete College America has recommended. Co-requisite remediation, 120 credits, 15 to finish, pathways to success, and we're working on structured schedules. We haven't quite conquered that one yet, but we're working
it's the
on
hardest.
It. So I think that that laid a very good foundation for us to take the next step forward. The way we thought about our students' success was really as a journey, and really that journey begins pre-K through 12. And so part of our strategy for student success is really working much more closely with public education and aligning what it is that we do with public education, what we do to advocate for public education, and what we do to provide opportunity in public education that our students would not otherwise have access to. So we've been working very hard to provide online programs that can be delivered right into the high schools that we hope will better prepare students to be competitive. So first thing is alignment and advocacy for public education. That's been a wonderful partnership. I think it's making a big, will make a big difference over time. So the first thing we look at is retention, right? That's really the first step. How can you make sure that your students are not going to leave at the end of the first semester? And believe it or not, there's a huge drop-off in freshman retention right after the first semester. And we want to keep them in there. Second is progress. How do you actually create your programs in such a way that you're going to help those students make the kind of very deliberate paced progress in the 15 to finish? On the way to completion, toward graduation, you also want to help them start thinking very seriously about a pathway to career or a pathway to graduate and professional education. So it really is a journey with these mile markers along the way. In sync with that, at the same time that we're doing that, we're really looking at other issues that really affect success. And we've all been reading about this now for about the last 2 years, I would say. And that is the role of persistence in what it means to complete college, what grit means and where grit can get a student, and how you even engage students in a conversation about grit. Helping students plan, planning becomes very important. And execution. In order to integrate what we know we need to be doing on the academic side with the persistence, the grit, the planning, the execution, and I could list about 10 other factors, we developed something called Project 168. And the name comes from the fact that there are 168 hours in a week. That's how many hours students are on a residential campus. The question we asked ourselves was, if they're in class 15 hours a week, what are they doing the rest of the time, right? That's a lot of time. If you break it down, it actually ends up, if you include things like showers and travel and eating and being with their friends and what?
Let's hope.
Let's hope. Showering, I thought, was a good one. spending a little time on social media so they remain connected, all of the things that our students like to do. In the end, you actually end up with about 20 hours in a week that really is completely unallocated for. And so we started thinking about Project 168 is, what can we do within those 20 hours to integrate not only their academic success, but their personal success and their professional success? Because we know that the academic success actually seldom happens without personal success. And ultimately, in terms of public trust in higher education, we want them to develop professionally as well. Now, what do we mean by developing in this personal way and professional way? And this really does come down to what we all know to be true, which is persistence, grit, planning, execution, discipline, all of those things that we don't necessarily talk about with students explicitly are actually the things that once someone has a knowledge base, make them a really, really good professional, a really good worker, someone who's going to make that $1 million difference because he or she graduated from college. So that Project 168, we are now using to integrate academic, personal, and professional growth. And we're doing that in a number of different ways. One is establishing learning living communities. I know that other schools who are represented in the room have these as well. They make a huge difference in terms of how the students bond with a cohort and with the university. And one of the things that we all know is that student engagement, bonding, and relationships with to a college or university is what can make the critical difference between retention and not. And so a lot of what we have put in place is to increase this engagement. So Project 168, the Learning Living Communities, we have something called Adventure West Virginia now, which we've expanded. It will serve 1,500 freshmen when they come in. These are 3 to 5 day options that students can engage in which they have to give up all of their technology. That's a challenge, right? Some students won't do it. But they have to give up all of their technology. They go out with 20 people and they either go camping or they go on an adventure course, like with zip lining, or a challenge course with climbing towers. Give my board a shout out, they did the zip line, which I think is pretty good. But what we discovered is the students who do this program, and this is why we expanded it to 1,500, the students who enroll in this program have a much higher retention rate, not just a statistically significant retention rate, but 20 percent points higher. Because when they first come in, what they're doing is bonding with a group of students, bonding with professors, and bonding with the institution. And we have heard over and over again from these students that when the going got tough and they thought they were going to drop out, they weren't going to retain, they contacted the people who had been in that group and they talked them into staying. And that's very powerful in that first freshman experience. In order to really wrap all of this in a bow, because someone really needs to keep his or her eye on how we're making progress and assessing this, we actually have created a position for a dean of completion. And that's what we're calling this person's position, the dean of completion. And the dean of completion is actually going to be responsible for taking all of these programs, making sure that they're working well, and beginning to assess very carefully the impact of these programs, because we're making some sacrifices in certain places to be able to make these other programs go. So just to wrap things up, I want to say that our board has been very critical in the development of these plans, have been fully supportive of these plans, and I don't think that we could have developed this plan going forward without the commitment of our board and our sense that we really have an obligation to work with our board to restore public trust in higher education. So thank you very much.
You know, Tom asked us to be engaged, and I don't know how you can not be engaged and excited when you hear about things like this. Isn't it wonderful? You have two items in your packet that I'd like to draw your attention to. You may get them out if you wish. One is on AGB letterhead, and it's called Draft Principles for AGB Statement on Completion. I have a slide. This slide summarizes that. I just wanted you to know that you have a fuller statement. The other, though, is an evaluation form for this session, which if you take it out now and doodle on it, you can turn it in but without interfering with your social hour. So, but yes, we are. Yes, I'm just going to do this really briefly, and then we'll have questions. So how can boards support this work? Aligning your policies with student ability to complete, you're doing that in a world-class fashion. Continue to pay attention to that. Holding your leaders accountable for achieving those goals, taking a look at the data regularly and asking about how progress is going and what's working and so on. Take an interest. Balance revenue needs and affordability with educational quality. And paying attention, as we've heard, to partner relations with transfer institutions and K-12 schools. All very consistent with what we've been hearing on the panel and very consistent with AGB recommendations for the board role in things like this. There are also some questions on student success that boards can be asking. There are two slides like this with some sample questions. I'll leave this one up for a little bit, and then I'll change to the other one, and you can look at them at your leisure. But at the moment, let me turn to our first question. Speak loudly, please.
Recommendations is to ask a difficult question without offending anybody. So I'm not real smart, but I fancy myself an observer of human behavior. So now we're going to emphasize completion and getting it done and attaining a degree. And the people who are in charge of the completion have a vested interest in the students completing because that's how they're evaluated by their graduation rate. So are there any checks and balances in place, or at least an awareness of the possibility that an unscrupulous, unethical institution, if one would exist, could possibly just lower the bar, let everybody jump over it, and guess what? We had a great graduation rate. So I'd just like to address that without offending anybody.
I'll just answer very, very quickly. There are two ways of doing that. One is you count the numbers and not the percentages. Right? Are you actually increasing the number of people graduating, or that's one. And the second is you disaggregate by different key groups, right? How are you doing with students of color? How are you doing with low-income Pell-eligible students? How are you doing with different groups, right? And ensuring that you're not decreasing access in an effort to increase your graduation rate. I think it's a very important thing to keep in mind that you're right. It's very easy for an institution to increase its graduation rate by increasing its entrance standards, right? So how do you maintain a commitment to access by looking at the populations of students that you're admitting and then seeing it through all the way to graduation?
How about at the other end though, Joyce, lowering the graduation requirements or the grading standards? What are the precautions?
Well, I was going to say the great checks and balance at our institution is a very engaged faculty and wonderful faculty senate leadership. And I'm actually, and our faculty senate president is here, which I really am glad, and who sits on our board of governors. I really do believe the faculty play a critical role in this, because they are our content and knowledge and critical thinking experts. And I think that they're very good at holding us accountable where they think that there is any possibility that rigor or quality is being traded for a graduation rate. So that would be my answer. That is a very strong check and balance.
Thank you. We have another question here.
That's okay.
One and then two.
I'm just curious, with freshmen that don't come back, as Dr. Hill said, is there a chance that statewide there's a matrix which would be an extended list of why they don't come back, and if every institution's required to report this by reason so that data can be looked at, and then those the highest percentages can be effectively action plans can be instilled to reduce that?
Joyce, I'm not sure if you have looked at that issue at WVU about why they particularly do not come back. But we know in that window between the freshman and sophomore year is where we do lose a great number of them. And as has been talked about here today, a lot of it's social pressures, not feeling that they fit in. I think that's why we're dipping all the way back to now starting in seventh grade and even lower of talking to students about attending college, bringing them onto college campuses so that they're not intimidated by it when they do get there. And then I think today's discussion is really important because now we're talking about that developing that rich and deep relationship with other people once they do arrive on campus, and of course working with them to structure along the lines of some of these things that will keep that data for that process. Your question, have we collected any information? I'm not sure we have yet. Yes, indeed, we would. I think what we do have is some exit data now. I know many of our institutions try to do an exit with a student before they leave, if they know before they disappear off the radar screen.
You know, there's increasing tools available to institutions now. There's a movement happening in higher education, just like there is in almost everything, every industry right now, around the use of data and data analytics, right? Where you can more effectively identify and actually, with big data sets, looking at all the data you have for multiple years at your institution, you can begin to identify trends and when students are high probability to drop out, whether that's on the entrance or in any other factors. And so those instruments, I mean, they're not, many of them are expensive, but the point is that they're available. And particularly when retention means dollars to your institution, it's a potentially worthwhile investment to consider because they can't, I mean, the tools themselves aren't going to solve the problem, but it's going to at least tell you what the problems are.
Mm-hmm. You have a question here and then one here. In
serving on several boards, corporation officials tell me that the students aren't taking the courses that they need to come to work for them. Is there a planning or an advising to tell them, you know, if you enter this field, there's very little chance of you being employed. Or if you enter this field, which you have some aptitude for, you probably will get a job when you graduate. Is any of that in this?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, all of that is in this. Students actually have advising. Every student has an advisor. The advising varies, though. Some students are seeing a team of advisors where the advisor is really just helping them with course scheduling. Other advisors are more focused on what the major is. But in terms of identifying what the student's aptitude is, those students can actually go through career services, and there's a very sophisticated aptitude test that they can take that shows them what kind of conditions they will work best in and what kind of careers. One of the things that we have done is become an educational advisory board guinea pig for one of their new big data analytic programs, and this one is very interesting because it can allow us to look at particular courses, find out if a student doesn't get a B in that course, that's predictive that they really can't do the rest of the program. And with that kind of sensitive data, we can actually get the advisors then to say, look, you got a C in this course. I don't think you should go on in the direction you're going on because the chances of you succeeding are very slim. So let's look at another pathway for you where you can be successful. That's the kind of fine-tuning we're trying to do with advising.
Here and then back there.
Okay, so. Hello? Yeah. So thank you, Joyce, for your kind words. I'm the incoming Faculty Senate Chair at West Virginia University, so Joyce, having said some nice words to me, she may regret them now when I ask her a question.
I wouldn't expect less.
I've got a very convoluted question. I'll try to narrow it down a little bit. Retention, completion, and then there's this 15 to finish, okay? The first two, I cannot support them more strongly. I think it's important that we retain our students and we get them to complete the degree. There was a statistic, I can't remember what, but I think it was on average 142 hours to graduate. From an academic standpoint, and I don't have kids, I'm not paying for them to go through school, but I don't philosophically, and I'm an engineer, so I should be careful here, but I'm not good on philosophy, I don't have a problem with that. And the reason I don't is I think it's important for everybody to go back to when you were 17 years old and understand, did you have any clue what you wanted to do? I didn't. You know, I think I've figured it out now. I'm 60. But even at 21, 22, I didn't know whether I was going to be what I am today. So my feeling is a lot of that, the 142 hours, which this gentleman, I think, brought up, there's two big reasons that that can happen. One is you're being advised badly. I don't think that happens a lot. I really don't. I mean, maybe it does in certain circumstances. I think what happens is kids do some hours, they go into business, decide they hate business and want to go and do something else. They've accumulated 15 extra hours that they don't need, and so it bumps up your statistics. So I know 120 hours to graduate, 15 to finish is what's being pushed, but I would ask everybody to temper that with the fact that you're dealing with young, sometimes very immature kids who take a while to figure out how to, you know, what they want, how they're going to do this, and it may take a little extra time. I know there's comments from there, but that's the way I see it from academia. Sure. So
I understand where you're coming from. Indeed, yes, we have many students that change majors all the time. But the bottom line is that, in fact, we don't do a very good job of advising students when they walk in the door in terms of being clear about a process for making some big initial choices. One of the problems, if you look at social economic theory, basically is when you throw a student 200 major program choices, I'd ask any one of you to think about how would I choose a major among 200 programs. Yeah. But maybe if you were to bucket it into maybe 8 different discipline areas, am I interested in STEM? Am I interested in social sciences? Am I interested in business? Am I interested in health sciences? And then from there, have them take some initial courses that are connected to those fields. Have them enter a major workshop that includes workforce information to say, okay, you're interested in health sciences. Here are the different jobs and the different majors within this program. Let's do some exploration using data analytics to show, well, if you can get at least a B in this course, you're going to be competitive for this program. And then once you've made a choice, give them a semester-by-semester plan of which courses to take. Believe it or not, that does not happen on the vast majority of campuses in this country.
No.
Institutions that do that, including Georgia State University, which is an urban institution, very high percentage of low-income African-American students have essentially closed their achievement gap and dramatically increased graduation rates and lower time to degree because of those strategies. So it's not to say, indeed, students are students, and there always are going to be students that are going to sort of wander through the institutions. That's not an excuse for institutions not to develop stronger, structured pathways for students. And in fact, the evidence suggests when you provide those pathways for students, more often than not, they take them. Because, first of all, keep in mind that $25,000 average student debt, right, is looking many students in the face. And that definitely is a reason why retention becomes a problem when they look at what it costs to take a higher education. So I think, yes, students are young and that they make choices that aren't always wise, but it doesn't mean the institution can't do better.
What we would determine, too, and I just want to add to that, is that this 12-hour business came from the fact that to be a full-time student, you need to take 12 hours. That's in state code. That is also the requirement for federal Pell Grants. You must take at least 12 hours in order to get the federal Pell. Well, students have sort of gotten it in their mind, that's all I need to take. And again, a simple little math exercise tells you you will not graduate in 4 years if you constantly take the minimum of 12 hours and be a full-time student. So we're encouraging students to simply stop, think about it, take these courses, get on one of these pathways so that they are taking 15 hours and that they can indeed, particularly the student who is driven and know what they want to do. And I agree, many students, I wandered around a little bit myself, so.
Could I just add one additional
quickly
observation? From England, I went through a program, I had no options. Take one optional course.
Well,
it was all laid out for me. Okay? I came to the States and I said, wow, you can reinvent yourself at any point in time.
You can.
That is the beauty of the American education system. So having the ability to change and switch when you don't make the right decision, with everything else being said, I still think it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
we have time for two more. One is back here, and one is right here.
Mine's very quick. Paul, I was very impressed and enlightened by the numbers that Dr. Vandal gave us. I wondered if you had those numbers in your possession, and if you could share them with us.
Which numbers are you referring to?
The statistics about who's in and who's out, what percentage is graduating, what percentage, and all the percentages he numbered.
Yes, we actually, Senator Craig, we have all of that in the report card that we publish each year. I don't know the specific ones that you recited today, but we can certainly supply all of that information to you.
It's online.
Yeah.
The real beauty of what WVU has done with Adventure West Virginia has created a collaboration among students during that weekly time frame. I've got a granddaughter who's graduating early in 3.5 years, and she was one of the initial classes of Adventure West Virginia. And the reason, Richard, she was able to sort of focus in on what she thought she wanted to do was a result of that program and the collaboration with other students, young freshmen who were stalking. They were talking to one another about, gee, what do you think we should do? And it really paid off with respect to my granddaughter. And I think by WVU expanding that program, I think we'll see big benefits from that. Mm-hmm. That's not a question. But
yeah. Well, I see lots of more eager interest, but we did promise you 5:30. And it's been a long afternoon. Would you help me thank this wonderful panel?
The other thing I'd like to ask is very quickly.
Yes, we have another question here. Dr. Berry.
Why do we wait until the children get into the institution? Is there still a family impetus to help these children graduate as well? I know that when I started the school, I was expected to graduate in 4 years. I learned that my first semester, my sophomore year, not having social media, how to play bridge. And you can play bridge 16 hours a day. And then I had a father show up and tell me that I needed to graduate on time. And I'm just wondering, do we still see the family impetus do that? And the other thing, Chancellor, the 12 hours, that got you a selective service deferment.
Yes. So it had lots of benefits. I just wanted to also go back to Senator Crago's question. When we first began working with Complete College America, we realized that 7 out of 10, 70% of the community college students needed some level of remediation in the state. That's why we really devoted most of the work there, because the problem was bigger. Now, we have some institutions in the four-year system that have approaching a 30%. So it's not a problem that we can ignore. And so we're implementing many of those same things to drive those numbers down so that we increase the students who are completing at a higher rate and will certainly persist once they get through those courses, because we call those gateway courses because they do indeed tend to knock those students out of completing their degree. But I will give you the full report. Well, thanks again for everyone for the panel. Yes. Ellen asked me to remind you that you have an evaluation form to fill out, if you would. I think you can leave those out at the front table if you would do so. We will invite you all to join us out front here for a reception that will start shortly. It will start now. It'll last for the next hour from now 5:30 until 6:30. At 6:30, we'll go into the salon next door for dinner, but Senator Manchin will be here, and he is on a fairly tight schedule. He has asked us to go in there promptly at 6:30. We'll hear his remarks and then have dinner served after he has completed his remarks. So that will be the schedule for beginning right now. Thank you.